benefits available to injured parties varies greatly. Suppose Plaintiff A has already received 100% of the total amount of his recoverable damages from collateral sources, and Plaintiff B, with an identical injury, may have no sources of collateral benefits. Under this rule, the fact finder is prohibited from considering the amount of compensation Plaintiff A has already received and is likely to award Plaintiff A and Plaintiff B the same compensation for the same injury. As a result, Plaintiff A receives twice as much as Plaintiff B for an identical injury. The statistics indicate that parties with the most significant injuries are disadvantaged in comparison to parties with minimal injuries who receive multiple recoveries for the same minor claim. The potential for double or triple compensation for minor injuries results in an unnecessary proliferation of litigation relating to minor injuries to the disadvantage of more major injuries which have not been fully compensated. For example, approximately 79% of all claimants in a recent study has had at least one collateral source from which to seek reimbursement after personal injury. The study which we've given to you in the materials that we've distributed also tells us that the average claimant in the study was compensated at a rate of approximately $1.40 for every $1 of economic loss. In some classes of claimants, reimbursement went as high as almost $4 for each $1 of economic loss, not a double but a triple recovery. We've had a significant proliferation of litigation. Between 1974 and 1985, there's been a 758% increase in the number of product liability lawsuits in federal district court, and the number of medical malpractice lawsuits per 100 physicians doubled between 1979 and 1980.
Tell me again what it is you're... Are you talking about in Oregon, nationwide? What's the source?
Report of the Tort Policy Working Group on the causes, extent, and policy implications of the current crises in insurance availability and affordability, 2 February 1986, hereinafter referred to in this document I'm reading from as the federal report, and I can provide that to the committee if you are interested.
It's underwires.
You say that the study showed on the average there was $1.40 for every dollar of economic loss.
That's correct.
Okay. Then you said in some cases it went up as high as 4.
That's correct.
And then you said that was not double but quadruple or something like
well,
that.
Well, my math but, may not
well,
be
no,
the
no,
best.
Well, no, I'm not checking your math there. But when you say over single recovery, You're leaving out the idea that the jury might want to give somebody something for the experience they've gone through. Do you call that double recovery, missing some of what you're talking about?
I'm not talking about the pain and suffering award. I'm talking about the hard costs of special damages. That's
you're talking about talking special about. Damages awards.
Special damage awards.
Limited to that.
That's correct. Now, certainly the trend is nationwide, both in statute and in case law, is to repeal the collateral source rule. At least 20 states have passed laws eliminating the operation of the collateral source rule in medical malpractice actions. During the 86 legislative sessions of Colorado and Illinois...
I wasn't quite finished. I'm not going to hold you up too long, but when this, if that 1.4, which was the average, is that taking into account the claims where there's a subrogation, the policies where there's a subrogation clause and the plaintiff is going to pay back?
I cannot tell you whether that is the case because I don't think the study, at least my reading of the study, does not indicate that it got into that specific area.
Well, I think we
area.
Need to know
but
that.
I think that is a significant point, and I think the legislation, as Mr. Maloney and Mr. Lang will be talking about later, we're going to not deal with the subrogated issues or the having the obligation to pay back certain premiums. There are certain exceptions to this rule.
So when you're saying double recovery, you're using an imprecise measurement of whether it was really double or whether it was some of it was paid back as
I have to concede that is the case, but I think that there is where there's smoke, there's fire, and I submit that it does have some probative value on this particular issue.
Light being shed on this whole issue sometimes, too.
Well, perhaps, but in any event, certainly the courts have recognized this, and in for purposes of brevity, and since we've all been here quite a long time, those materials are in the materials that we've given to you, and certainly it has been judicially criticized.
Well, okay. Now, I hope you're going to, I want you to address, I don't want to interrupt, but I want you to address this at some point in time, whether it's today or next week, but let us know how you think. You see, I don't have any objection to a system that says if a plaintiff is has a hospital bill of $1,000 and as part of the request for special damages, there's $1,000 in medical bills, and so the jury adds $1,000 in special damages to the verdict. And in most cases, as I understand it, and this is my own experience, the $1,000 is going to have to be paid over to the hospital by the plaintiff who recovers it. Now, I don't have any objection to some system that assures that that be done, or some but I would have an objection if it comes down to a choice as to whether the defendant's insurance company is going to have to pay the $1,000 or the plaintiff doesn't get it. That is, if it's a policy question as to whether the defendant's insurance company should cough this up even though it's already been paid. I think I'd come down on the side of the injured person there. So what I'd like to have some input on is, can we devise some method of assuring that if the provider is paid, that the provider is going to get paid back? I mean, is that because I don't have any objection to that. Go ahead.
Senators, if I may continue. I'm Bob Maloney. I'm a partner with the Spears Liberski firm in Portland, and I'm chairing the OADC subcommittee that is addressing the collateral source issue. I've been practicing about 19 years now, and my practice deals primarily in the defense of individuals, self-insured businesses, and some insurance companies. Basically, the situation that we're talking about, there's two ways to approach it. There's a more liberal way to approach it, and there's a conservative way to approach it. I submit that the bill that you have in front of you is a conservative way to approach it, and one I think that is in keeping with Senator Frey's earlier comments about, well, why provide a benefit to the defendant when the defendant didn't pay the premium. Basically, we're talking about the situation where somebody is injured, and say they incur $5,000 in medical bills and $10,000 in loss of income. That individual has bought and paid for their own insurance policy that's going to reimburse them for the medical bills and for the time loss. In addition to that, their employer or their union has a similar provision that will also compensate them for that. All right. Those are considered collateral sources, and historically in Oregon, a jury isn't told that that's happened, even though maybe a jury ought to be told, because if, for example, you're sued by somebody that is injured and they claim they can't work and they have not worked for 3 years, and they come into court claiming, say, $50,000 in loss of income against you, maybe some motivation for that person having been off work is the fact that they've been able to sit around and collect tax-free these benefits. And maybe you would like to have your lawyer that's defending you in that case be able to point out to the jury, say, maybe there's something wrong with this claim. Maybe the person isn't working because they're not motivated, because they're getting these collateral benefits, right? On a more liberal approach to it, you would allow that kind of evidence in. I'm not urging that you do that. The bill that you have before you doesn't allow that kind of approach, but I'm submitting to you that it is an approach that has been taken by some courts and other jurisdictions to correct that kind of a potential abuse. Second, in that same light, is there really a moral or social justification to say that if a person is in an accident, should they recover three times for the same damage? That is, if they happen to incur $5,000 in medical expenses and have an insurance policy that doesn't have a subrogation provision, and they have a union benefit that will pay them for those same $5,000 in medical bills, but again, the union doesn't get reimbursed, and that person collects for those same bills twice there, and they can still file a lawsuit and seek to recover the same $5,000 against you if you're that defendant, Is it just that that kind of thing occurred? I submit that it isn't, but the argument on the other side is, well, if you caused the damage, maybe you ought to have to pay for it, and if the plaintiff has had the foresight to buy an insurance policy that covers him, that's his business. The way the bill reads, it would allow that so that there wouldn't be any offset, and I'm suggesting to you that I think that the bill is a right start, and I'm not suggesting that you change it. In other words, I'm supporting the bill as it's written and suggesting that in those instances where the plaintiff has himself or herself paid for their own insurance that covers their bills, or their employer has paid for that, don't deduct it. Don't admit it into evidence. Don't have the judge reduce the amount of the judgment for it. Let them, in effect, make that double or triple recovery. That's what this bill would permit, and I say, let's at least make a start, which I think this bill does. Where this bill will affect things is in this kind of a situation. Somebody here asked, well, don't most insurance policies have a subrogation provision? If they have a subrogation provision, what that means is simply that if you cause an injury to somebody and you pay for their medical bills, and that person has already recovered for the medical bills from their own insurance company, when they collect from you, they have to pay their insurance company back. Well, in almost all automobile policies, you've got subrogation. Where, in my experience, you don't have it is on your homeowner's policy. Every person who owns a home or rents an apartment typically has a homeowner's policy. In that homeowner's policy, besides covering fire loss to your home, there's liability coverage. So how about this situation? You got a friend that comes over to your home, and they slip and they fall, and they've got a bad fracture, and they run up $5,000 in bills at your home. Your insurance policy that you paid the premiums on provides what they call guest medical coverage, and it's typically $5,000. Sometimes it's more. So this person's bills are $5,000. Your homeowner's policy pays the $5,000 to this person that got hurt at your home. Fine, it's all over? No, because that person maybe feels like they ought to recover something. So they turn around and they file a lawsuit against you. So now your same homeowner's policy that has already paid $5,000 to this person for medical bills, now you've got to provide coverage for the same medical bills that are being included in a lawsuit against you so they can recover a second time. And most homeowner's policies that I've seen don't have a subrogation provision. So the end result is the person first collects from your insurance policy that you paid the premiums on $5,000 for their medical under this guest medical provision. Then they come back and they file a lawsuit against you, and your same insurance policy has to wind up paying them through a court action or settlement, however it works out, for the same $5,000.
Why doesn't the insurance company rewrite the policy then?
I don't know. But here's an opportunity for the legislature to at least deal with it, and you are dealing with it because that's the end result of this bill that you have is going to be to prevent that. By legislation, you are saying here that, look, you can't recover twice because that collateral, that's going to be offset by the court against the verdict. You can't recover for those same bills twice.
Well, let's go back to this hypothetical where you had the injured employee and the $5,000 in lost, I think it was a lost wage.
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
And so he's got an insurance, or maybe it was medical. Medical.
It does. Okay, say medical.
Right.
Sure.
All right, the medical benefits. He's got his own private health and accident policy, and so that company pays for the $5,000 worth of medical expenses. He's got a union contract, and so he gets $5,000 under the union contract, and then he goes to court, and he gets $5,000 from the negligent defendant for the same medical.
From one of us.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, there's no difficulty with me understanding a requirement that says that he's got to take that $5,000 the jury gave him and give it to one or the other or split it up with these other folks. What bothers me is saying that just because of that coincidence and that party's foresight, that you, the insurance company representing the negligent party, are going to be able to get off the hook for the $5,000. Now, that's the part that bothers me.
And I'm agreeing with you. I'm saying that the way that I think if you want to carry this through to really a moral or a social issue, we ought to say that, look, let's not allow it to happen regardless of how it happens, that somebody can recover three times tax-free for the same loss. But I'm agreeing with you in the sense that I say, look, let's take a start and see how this works, and let's test it out, because we agree that it isn't fair for the defendant here to itself provide guest medical coverage under your homeowner's policy that pays the injured person, and then allow that injured person to come back and take a second crack at you, where you're the one that's had to pay all those premiums. And that's all this bill would address. So it's very limited. And I support it, and I say, for now, let's deal with this and see how it works out. And if we need to come back some future time after we've got some history here, then let's deal with it. But at least this is a positive start. So I'm in support of what you're saying. One suggestion I have, by the way, is I think that there's a typographical error on Section 3 of that bill, because it says evidence of collateral benefits subject to this section may be introduced by any party to the action and may be required by the court of any party. I think it should read be required by the court or any party rather than of. So I think that the intent is that the court or any party can require that be introduced. So I think that the word ought to be or.
Well, all right. Put it in words.
I think what you're saying sounds pretty reasonable. So, and I'm
taking a real conservative approach.
I'm encouraged that this looks like it might be an area, and I'm sure we're going to hear more reasons why what you're saying doesn't work or isn't right. But I just want to say that I've been really discouraged about this whole undertaking, that it might be too much. Everybody getting just totally polarized on every darn issue as we come along. And I like your testimony, but I would say one thing about it, and that is, and maybe this is just a friendly comment, it makes it harder when you say, let's start this way and then maybe we come back. Because when you want to change something, that one of the things that people who like it the way it is say is, if we change it some this time, then they'll be back next time for the rest of it. But I don't want to ruin my nice remark by saying something critical.
Let me just follow up on that. I think that if we're going to deal with tort reform, and I think that the public is demanding that we do some things in tort reform, then I think the answer is the bill with respect to this provision, does it make sense? Is it reasonable? As opposed to saying, gee, even though it's reasonable and makes sense and we ought to do it and it's going to save all of us money, let's not do it because we're afraid that sometime in the future somebody might say, well, gee, we ought to make it a little different. I think that if it makes sense and is reasonable, that I would urge that you adopt it, at least submit it to the full Senate for them to consider.
Other questions by Commissioner?
No, I'd ask them, as a favor to me, to sort of, not now, but go through the sub 3 section and kind of clarify that for me from your point of view when we get around to the real markup of this. So that's.
Do you want us? Would you want us to do that today or write a letter?
No,
perhaps?
Oh no. I don't want to take any more time. I just want to note it for you.
We'll write a letter to say Eric Carlson to cover our thoughts on that, and he can share it with you. How's that?
I think I'd like a little help. On the procedure at the end of the trial for Senator Cohen's talking about, at the end of the trial for seeing that the $5,000 that your company has paid through this jury verdict is reimbursed, if that's the way it ought to be done. Procedure for getting that done. Maybe now
there are procedures. We've done it on railroad cases, for example, where I've defended Southern Pacific, where you've got a railroad retirement board lien. And so I'll give you some examples. I'll even send in copies of some of the documents that we filed with the court covering that, so you can see how that works mechanically. And if you think you need to modify this, we'll give you some guidance on that.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Brockman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Maloney, for your information, we get these little things in our packets from one side of this issue or another. And I see, according to your letterhead, that you are a member of both the Oregon and the Washington Bar.
That's correct.
I have stories here from the Seattle Times. The Times story says, did the state get suckered? The other one says that as of January 10th, the bill that they passed up there should be repealed, and it went too far and did all kinds of things. I don't know whether your Washington State bar is because you have an office in Vancouver. Do you practice there
as well?
I practice
in both states.
Well, can you give us a lowdown? How's it doing? Is it working?
Well, I personally think that it's too soon to tell, frankly. I think that any time you have legislation as far-reaching as the Washington legislation, that you're going to have people who are critical of it for various reasons and various interests, but I think it's too early to tell whether it's a good or a bad bill.
A follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
How closely does ours parallel theirs? I know the numbers are different on the caps considerably, but...
I can't comment on that, to be honest with you, because I haven't studied the Washington bill as closely as I have the Oregon.
Thank you.
I will find out about that and cover that in the correspondence that we'll send in for you, though.
Another question by committee members. Senator Hamby.
Briefly, do you recall the implementation date of the Washington Act?
It was last June or July, I think. July, yes.
I think it was August 1.
August 1? Okay.
August 1.
So, I mean, you're looking at comments 4 or 5 months later, and I just think that it's really too early to tell with that because of the effective date in it, because it didn't automatically apply to cases that were filed before then. In fact, I represent some plaintiffs, and in my office, we filed several cases just before the cutoff date to be under the old statute. So I question how many cases have even gone to trial under the new statute by this time.
Senator Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, you've touched on something that bothers me about this whole area. In Washington, you say there hasn't been enough time. I mean, has there been enough time really anywhere to see where any of this is going? And we're being pushed and rushed, perhaps without enough information. So when do you think we will have enough information really to evaluate some of these things that are being done?
I think that the provisions that we're dealing with here, that there's been enough time and there's been enough experience as far as why there's a need for what we're doing. For example, on our collateral source,
yes.
What you're talking about here is frankly a very conservative approach.
I mean, I don't mean
okay.
The comments, the question asked by Senator Brockman did not cover your area. It covered that was a general remark about tort reform in general, and I thought you were responding in that vein.
I'm sorry. I think there hasn't been enough time would be in such areas as maybe a cap rate. You know, how many cases really are going to be ones that exceed $500,000 in non-economic damage? How many times are you going to have problems with the definitions of non-economic loss? What I submit to you is that maybe we haven't seen enough experience to know yet from other jurisdictions that have a cap rate, how does that really impact that state? Because most cases are, as one of the senators brought out, cases where the verdict is substantially below that. You just happen to read about all the $500 million verdicts, and the plaintiff's bar, of course, is concerned about those cases.
But we are being pushed to put for the caps and all those things.
See, they have an economic effect, it seems to me, on the economy of Oregon, because if you don't do something about tort reform, maybe you're sending out the wrong message to businesses. I mean, just forget insurance companies for a minute, but just talk about attracting companies to do business in Oregon versus going to Washington or some other state where the economic climate is better. And by doing something on tort reform, I think you're sending out a message that we're concerned about the cost of doing business, not necessarily of just insurance companies, but about private businesses who wind up having to pay the cost of some of the abuses in the system.
I know we're getting back to the whole issue of whether this really affects insurance rates. That's what we're talking about, and that's never, never land from what I can tell so far.
And that leads me to ask you now, going back to the same hypothetical you and I have discussed, if your insurance company has to end up paying the $5,000 so the original provider can get repaid, which I think is the right way to go, how's that going to save anybody on insurance premiums?
Well, here's how. It's the way the bill is written, it ought to save you and me on our homeowners policies, because every time that there's a claim under that policy, that's going to affect our premiums. And if we've got two claims for the same accident, moreover paying for the same damage, the same $5,000 in bills, seems to me that that's going to jack up my premiums and yours. And so this bill addresses that. So I think it's a positive step.
OK. Okay. Any other questions? All right. Gentlemen, thanks. And now we will have you back again when we go to a section, when I continue sections 11 and 12. So the fact you didn't have a chance to say something today doesn't mean that you're precluded.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Hamby.
I suggest that they be put on the witness stand first the next time.
Yes, indeed. I think so.
So there won't be any delays.
Delays.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator, I was going to appear only today in section 11. Do you have an idea now when that
was? I think we probably put that on next. That's right. You didn't have a chance yesterday on that, did you?
No, I didn't actually.
Why don't you be in touch with counsel and make sure you get a chance. You tell him what day's the worst for you, and we'll try to avoid that day.
Well, that's fine. Whatever comes up.
Okay. Appreciate your input, gentlemen, committee members. We're adjourned at 5:25, 5:26.
Yes, yes.
But there are some things that are a matter of principle.
That's the rest of it. I'd forgotten about
it. Remember, this is for economic development.
Your experience.
Yeah.
From my experience. Experience reading.
Yeah. Flush that out.